I think there's something bee-like about that sting. A very low, thrumming, humming sound. As you know, dear listener, this program has been absolutely besotted with the marvellous animal-based books published by Reaction, and over the last year I've talked to authors of a number of them. I think back to the mosquito, the frog, the hyena, and tonight we turn our attention to the humblebee, not the bumblebee, and most particularly to the significant roles they've played in the art and politics and social thought of human cultures. Now, joining me from the Bee in Cambridge is Claire Preston. Claire is Professor of Early Modern Literature at the University of Birmingham, and she's the author of Bee. Claire, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Right at the beginning of your book, you write that bees are everywhere, but despite their huge geographical spread, their cultural territory has been somewhat limited. Why is that?
Well, the cultural territory that's limited is that of the political bee that has a very extensive hive organization and produces the honey that we all enjoy. And that geographical area is limited to temperate climates where there are cold winters, and bees form large colonies so that they can make a lot of honey in order to survive the winter, and are also tractable enough to be kept semi-domestically as we keep them in artificial hives. So the kinds of cultural meanings that they have that are specifically to do with human society and very meaningful to humans are to do with the Apis mellifera, the European or Western honeybee, which is the one that fulfills all those categories and lives in those sorts of climates.
Of course, in other parts of the world, in Southern Africa, the Indian subcontinent, and even in Australia, prior to the arrival of European bees, indigenous people, find them, but yes, they're not domesticated.
Well, they're not. I mean, I would suggest that no sort of bee is fully domesticated. I think it's a bit, it's hard to know quite what the analogy is, but these are animals that consent to behave in their natural way under enhanced conditions that we provide them with. So we may think of them as domesticated, but they're not domesticated in the ways that cows are or sheep or even, I suppose, salmon in salmon farms. They're doing what they would do naturally. We're just allowing them or persuading them to do it nearby and conveniently for us.
And Claire, if you don't do it properly, as I know from to our cost, a hive can get very angry.
Hives can get very angry. It's true. And bees will defend their hives and their territory very, very belligerently, especially against other bees, but also against predators, including mankind. But mostly the thing that we think of as the angry bee is the bee swarming. And a swarm of bees is, in fact, not an angry group of bees. It's a group of bees that are very pragmatically looking for another nesting place, and they're absolutely stuffed with honey because that's how they're going to travel a great distance, and they can't sting, and they're not interested in stinging. They're looking for their next site in which to form a new hive in the wild.
Claire, how far back can we trace the practice of beekeeping, if we can use that term loosely, although, as you point out, it's somewhat inaccurate?
Yes, well, beekeeping is probably about 5,000 years old. There are Sumerians and Mesopotamian and latterly ancient Greek and Egyptian beekeeping and merchant activity, selling honey. The first really, shall we say, technical or high-tech beekeepers are the Egyptians. And they have the perfect sort of climate for the kind of bee that produces high honey yields. It probably originates before that, but the first really powerful records we have of what they're doing, how they're keeping their bees, their technique is from the Egyptians. Of course, there's honey hunting for thousands of years before that,
yes,
hunting
of
wild hives.
And there's other sources of ultra-sweet. I've been out in the desert in my country with Aboriginal women who track down honey ants,
yes,
which their grandmothers, might have visited decades earlier. Now, tell me about Virgilian bees.
Virgilian bees are the heroes of one whole book. That's 25% of one of Virgil's most important works, which is the Georgics. The Georgics are is essentially a collection of four long poems, each one about an aspect of husbandry and agriculture. And it's interesting that he selects bees over every other animal to be the subject of one of these poems, and he tells us a great deal about the polity of bees, by which I mean their very elaborate social and political structures. Now, Virgil, like a lot of ancient writers, is not fully apprised of what bees are actually doing, and so there's a lot of what now seems to us charming but merely mythological information. But nevertheless, what he's doing is talking about the bee as an emblem of good government and of obedience to good government. And it's interesting that Virgil's one of the classical writers who thinks of tending the land and its creatures and its products as a withdrawal from the equivocal or downright unpleasant and nasty features of political life as we know it in the city and in actual human government. You do that a bit and then you retire to the country and run your farm. And the main creature that he has to tell us about when he retires to the country and runs his farm is the bee. So it has a terrific emblematic and moral heft that he's invoking in sort of giving a message to Rome generally about how things should actually be run in the ideal world.
Ellen Nell on RN, and my guest is Claire Preston, who's Professor of Early Modern Literature, University of Birmingham, and she's the author of Bee. One of his, as you point out, one of his most interesting conceits is that of bees as commercial creatures, their hive, the busy shop, the bees themselves as trading citizens.
Absolutely. These bees, and Virgil's not the only one, all of the ancient and, shall we say, pre-modern writers about bees are very aware that the bee is not a kind of romantically withdrawn a contemplative creature. It's a creature that is involved with tasks, roles, commerce, government, punishment, reward. It's a very modern kind of creature in a lot of ways.
And that notion is echoed by Trollope. It's also spoken about by Thoreau, isn't it?
Indeed. Thoreau is very interested in the bees as sort of natural citizens of the New England landscape, and he particularly compares them to nicely to the burghers of the little New England towns that he knows, working like mad to get ahead and get, not perhaps individually, but to get ahead for the hive.
We've just been talking about the problems of democracy in Bulgaria, and the bee didn't come up, but at any time of political instability, they're likely to so do, because you point out that anxiety about political and social disorder in the early modern period made the bee that constant example of efficiency and careful government.
Yes, I think it's very interesting that the really intensely active bee writing in English literature coincides with the rise of the Tudors and the concomitant rise under their government of things like the civil service and a kind of paternalistic hierarchy in which, you know, everybody knows their place but is nevertheless capable of a certain amount of advancement. So the bee is the bee itself, the individual bee, does not seek advancement, but the hive is a kind of entity which suggests, you know, national progress and well-being, starts to look extremely attractive, especially because it's a monarchical structure.
Claire, as a not very efficient apiarist, I leave that to the missus. I'm aware of some of the most remarkable and often ludicrous claims made for honey, you know, as a universal panacea and miracle product. It's pretty damn good, but it's not capable of, as far as I know, of curing cancer. But there are many other fantastical notions of the intellectual and ethical powers of bees.
Well, there are. Bees are bees are emblematic until relatively recent times, almost universally emblematic of certain virtues, virtues of selflessness, of extremely hard work, of purity, both spiritual and intellectual purity, also sexual purity. They were said to be born without procreative acts of various kinds, you know, so that they spontaneously generate from either dead animals or from dew or from the stars, depending on which century and which writer you read.
Well, I through you have been reading Thomas Moffat. The 16th century naturalist, and he has apian duties, including regimental guard duty, psychic burial and trumpeting. And his bees, of course, are monarchists who mourn the loss of their king with tragical lamentation.
They do indeed. Moffat's bees are really a kind of, it's like reading Chaucer or Piers Plowman. You know, everybody has a task, and the social organization of the hive is very anthropomorphic, so that, you know, anything that would happen in medieval or early modern culture, for example, the death and succession of monarchs and the appropriate mourning and celebration and so on, all goes on in bee life, and you see that constantly in Moffat, and he invents some extremely good roles. You know, the nurse bees are imagined as actually nursing bees, and, you know, looking after them in their cradles, and the cleaners, you know, and the porters, and all the kinds of things you would see in a, you know, typical 16th century village or town or city or indeed royal court.
Well, the followers of Mr. Moffat, not to be confused with someone of a similar name, must have suffered a great shock when it was revealed to them that the king bee was in fact a queen.
Well, indeed, it is always said that the true sex of the monarch bee was not known until the early 17th century. In fact, that's not true. It was either asserted or strongly suspected for at least 100 years, if not more, ahead of that. But there's an extremely interesting book written by a musicologist and vicar called Charles Butler, who wrote an absolutely wonderful little book called The Feminine Monarchy, in which in his spare time in the country he'd been observing his bees and had rightly determined that the monarch bee is female and lays eggs.
Forgive me interrupting, some extent, was he trying to sort of get on excellent terms with Elizabeth I?
Well, this was published after her death. A bit late. I mean, retrospectively, I'm sure it would have pleased James, since his assumption of the throne was, you know, via his relationship to Elizabeth. So he had an interest in her legitimacy as a regnant female monarch. But Charles Butler is extremely interesting because he talks about, he reproduces the songs that bees sing, the different castes of bees. He even reproduces it in musical notation. He has a wonderful story, one of my favorite ever bee stories, which kind of yokes a lot of the ideas that are handed down in folklore about bees, that an old woman opened her hive and found that the bees had what he calls a murine, or some kind of a bee disease, and she wondered what to do about it. So she went to church and took communion, but instead of ingesting the host, she carried it back with her and put a fragment of the wafer in the hive and closed it up. And when she came back some weeks or months later, she not only found that the bees had recovered, but they had built a chapel of wax in the hive. On the altar was lying the fragment of the host. They were buzzing around in harmony, singing to the host, and they had built waxen bells which were ringing in the hives.
Dear,
exactly. I mean, I don't think that Butler believes this. He just thinks it's a really good story. But it's a wonderful idea that, you know, bees are animated by these sorts of spiritual impulses that animate some of us.
Well, another author of the era who is besotted with the bee, of course, is Shakespeare. There's so many bee references, aren't there?
Zillions. It's
zillions.
Yes. To use a sort of buzzy B word. Yes. I mean, he's one of the great enunciators of the bee as the supporter and creator of the perfect polity. He's the one who says that he describes them as creatures that, by a rule in nature, teach the act of order to a peopled kingdom, and then goes on to talk about all the different roles that bees have and their relationship to the monarch bee. This is in Henry V, interestingly enough.
I think you should sing "Where the Bee Sucks, There Suck I" at this point.
Yeah.
Do you have a lovely singing voice, Claire?
I have not, and even if I did, I don't think I would. I would be tempted to blight Australia with my singing.
Yeah, but there's so many, as you say, zillions of references in the writings of the great man. But I hadn't realised the place of the bee in the period of the American and French revolutions.
Yes. Yeah. It's very interesting. Before I started doing my own research, I knew about the French relation with bees, but what I didn't know was that the Americans started it. Now their use of the bee as an emblem of a kind of enlightened, not monarchy, of course, but a kind of hierarchical democracy, which is sort of what happened in 1776, or what was being proposed in 1776, seems to attract some bee emblems. So you see hive motifs and so on some of the early printed money and in various other symbols. And I've often wondered whether indeed the dome of the Capitol building somehow refers to an old-fashioned scap shape.
Could well be the case. And of course, yeah. Napoleon quite liked the bee, didn't he? He used it as his symbol.
Well, it's interesting. It starts with the French Revolution in France. They use the bee not only because it is selfless and working for the greater good of the Commonwealth, but it's also quite clear that the hexagonal shape of the honeycomb cell, the individual cell, reminds French revolutionaries of the shape of France. And you can, if you sort of superimpose a hexagon on France, you can see why that might be. But yes, the bee becomes a terrific symbol for them. And then when Napoleon takes over, he is no Democrat, but he is co-opting the bee imagery, not only from the revolution, but from the Merovingian kings who used bees. So he's kind of harking back to a sort of prior French, original and possibly ideal monarchy, or what is thought to have been ideal monarchy, and indeed also I've often wondered whether it's a subtle reference to the fleur-de-lis, which is the royal symbol. If you look at the fleur-de-lis and the bee, you could easily mistake which one was which from a distance. So yes, Napoleon's using it very strategically and very much as a branding exercise for his rule.
I often complain about the length of book titles on this program. Many books written by academics these days have one statement as a title and then an endless list of words appended to it. Claire's book, on the other hand, has the shortest title, I think, of any book that I've come across in the last few years. It is simply Bee. Now, you've refused to sing with me, so what I'm going to do instead is quote the poem of Emily Dickinson, which, as you say, is laconic by even her own severe standards. I love this. "Partake as doth the bee, abstemiously. A rose is an estate in Sicily." Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, very good.
What a woman.
She likes her bees a lot. That's not her only bee poem. There's a wonderful poem in which she talks about the bee as a kind of the drunkard of the garden and of the world, sort of becoming elated in its connection with nature, and particularly, using the notion of the gathering of nectar as a kind of almost like a drinking exercise. And I think that she's subtly criticizing the very much more puritanical and severe background from which she came, and which would have informed the behavior and attitudes of 19th century New England.
Talking about the 19th century, there's a change of attitude about bees. They trouble some 19th century observers, and the bee begins to acquire, as you say, the baggage of threat, distaste, and even horror.
Yes. Yeah, it actually begins earlier than the 19th century. I think I locate the beginning of this to the development of high-quality lenses for microscopes in the 17th century, where not just bees, but especially vermin of all kinds, but very small creatures like fleas and lice and so on, start to be able to be looked at very carefully, and bees are among the first things that are looked at by scientists with decent lenses. And if you take that idea, meld that with the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, where a lot of people start working in factories doing repetitive tasks, and you know, the satanic mills start to seem like places of horror rather than, you know, commercial enterprise and success. The bee is now somehow a lot less like us, and in the sense that we can see it in the microscope and see that it's nothing like humans and could never be. But on the other hand, we seem to be much more like the more disturbing aspects of hive life, which is the complete unselfed quality of the bee, that the bee as an individual doesn't exist. I start my book with the phrase, una apis nulla apis, one bee is no bee. There is no such thing as a bee. They're merely bees. And bees can only work together, and that's great. But when you start to make the analogy between what bees do in hives to what, say, you know, hideously underpaid and undernourished factory workers were doing in the steel and cotton mills in early 19th century England, you start to see how the bee doesn't seem quite so charming.
And here we are, we're just warming up with your extraordinary studies, but this leads us to the horror and science fiction films of Hollywood, which coincides with that post-war American hysteria over communism, which I personally recall very vividly.
Indeed. As do I, although only vaguely as a child and not with very much understanding, but absolutely. And it's that, and it's also, I think, a racial hysteria. It's racial and it's political. It's initially a Cold War hysteria about, you know, invading hordes of, you know, godless communists of various kinds. But if you then look at the Hollywood, more recent Hollywood uses of bees, it's to do with the hysteria about the killer bees and the Africanized killer bees. And that immediately for the United States has all these overtones that suggest unpleasant truths to.
Well, Hitchcock would later do it with birds, but
you list
a whole stack of films which I'd forgotten.
Yeah. Well, most of them are very forgettable, but it's very interesting the way the notion that these really angrily swarming bees, not happily swarming, but angrily swarming bees, are specifically an Africanized strain, by which they simply mean that they're crossbred with a certain African species.
I could suggest that there's now another linkage, and that is to the dread of nanotechnological sort of electric insects, you know, which is now being debated. And of course, the bee and other insects like that are the inspiration for them.
You're absolutely right. I think there's a lot in that. And there's an extremely weird film from the early 1990s called Wax, or The Discovery of Television Among Bees. Don't even ask me why it's called that. But it's essentially about bees being kind of a combination of eco and techno terrorists, and inserting controls inside people's brains and making them do strange things.
On that happy note, I've got to take my leave of you. I've got overexcited. Claire's book, Bee. It's a part of that wonderful series of animal-based books published by Reaction. Thanks, Claire. On our next, Vanity Fair writer Mark Seal tells us about the court case involving Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird, and she's suing her agent for duping her into signing over the copyright to her book. Don't forget, you can comment on any of our stories by going to the website abc.net.au/radio national. where you'll find a link to the program, and you can also tweet us. The news is next on RN, and we will see you later.